Imagine you're looking at your firm's internal dashboard. It's like a random Tuesday morning. Everything seems perfectly normal, you know?
Right.
But because some operations desk ignored a, well, like a slightly mismatched zip code on a new account application, millions of dollars are just quietly vanishing from your firm.
Oh, yeah.
And it's being routed to a sanctioned country. It is literally an absolute nightmare
It's the
scenario.
kind of thing that ends careers.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And today we are going to look at the exact FENINAR rules that are designed to prevent that exact disaster. But before we get into the weeds, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got a full Series 99 course with, you know, adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing. It is incredibly helpful if you are prepping for this exam.
It really is.
Yeah, check it out at certfuel.com.
It's a lifesaver, especially for the heavy regulatory sections we're tackling today, honestly.
Oh, for sure. All right, let's get into it. Today's deep dive is entirely focused on a topic that is just an absolute beast for anyone taking the Series 99 exam, which is escalating complaints and red flags. We're pulling directly from the FENINAR rule book, specific regulatory notices regarding customer grievances, and the latest exam study guides for operations professionals.
Yeah, and I think we should set the stakes right out of the gate here. If you're studying for the 99, this material falls under Function 2.
Which is massive. I mean,
Yep.
Function 2 contains 15 scored items.
Yep.
That makes up 30% of the entire Series 99 exam. We cannot gloss over
Oh,
this.
you really can't.
But our mission today isn't just to, you know, read you the textbook definitions. If you have ADHD like me, dry lectures go in one ear and out the other.
Oh, absolutely.
Memorization won't save you when the test writers start throwing complex, multi-layered scenarios at you. We need to understand the underlying mechanics, you know, the why behind the rules, so you can actually outsmart the trick questions.
And that is the only way to genuinely master the material. The rules exist for highly specific reasons, usually written in blood, or at least, written in massive financial losses.
Right.
Once you understand the mechanism of the regulation, the exam questions actually become quite predictable.
Okay, I love that. So, to help us map this out, we are going to rely on a cast of recurring characters. Having a narrative makes this sticky. First up, we have Angry Alice.
Oh, Alice.
Yeah, Alice is a client who complains about absolutely everything. She will yell at you about her portfolio's performance and, in the exact same breath, demand to speak to a manager because the firm's waiting room coffee is too cold.
We all know an Alice.
Yeah,
Every single firm has an Alice.
we really do. Next, we have Panicked Paul. Paul is a very sweet but highly anxious client. He is constantly terrified that someone is stealing his identity. Every misplaced piece of mail, every unrecognized phone call is a vast criminal conspiracy to him.
Right, poor Paul.
Yeah. And finally, we have Shady Sam. Sam is a mysterious figure, always operating in the gray areas, submitting documents that don't quite add up. He might actually be trying to commit fraud, or he might just be terrible at paperwork.
Right.
We'll be checking in with Alice, Paul, and Sam throughout this deep dive.
I think this is a great framework because, as an operations professional, you are the firm's first line of defense against all three of those personalities. You're essentially the bouncer at the door,
Okay.
you're the guard in the watchtower. Correctly recognizing an issue means prompt escalation to the right department. If you misclassify Alice's complaint, or you completely miss Sambra's red flag, the firm fails to apply the right regulatory records and reporting processes.
Wow.
Yeah, the whole compliance system breaks down before it even starts.
Okay, so let's start with the loud problems. If a client is mad, we usually know it. Let's bring in Angry Alice. I'm operating under the assumption that if a client starts yelling at me or sends a furious letter to the firm, that is automatically a regulatory complaint that has to go on a permanent record and gets forwarded to FENINAR. If they are mad at the firm, it's a complaint, right?
Not even close.
Really?
No, if firms had to officially log and escalate every single time a customer was unhappy, the entire financial system would grind to a halt.
Okay, fair point.
Right, so for written complaint record keeping, specifically looking at FENINAR Rule 4530, the definition of a customer complaint has three very strict pillars.
Okay, what are they?
First, it is a grievance from a customer or their authorized representative. Second, it must involve the activities of the member firm or an associated person.
Okay.
And crucially, the third pillar, it must connect to soliciting or executing a transaction or disposing of that customer's securities or funds.
Wait, let me test that. Let's say Angry Alice is having a terrible day. She goes home gets out her fancy stationery and sends a beautifully handwritten, wax-sealed letter to her broker.
Very dramatic.
Very Alice. And the letter says, "Your ties are hideous, you talk way too loud during lunch, and your receptionist was rude to me. It's embarrassing."
Okay.
So, we have a grievance. It's definitively from a customer, and it is in writing. Does the firm have to escalate that to compliance as a formal complaint?
This is exactly where the test writers try to trick you. They will dress up the scenario to look incredibly formal. A wax-sealed letter, sent by certified mail, signed by the client. It feels important, you know?
Yeah, it feels very official.
But written form alone does not create a written customer complaint under the regulatory definition. It is entirely missing the covered activity condition.
Because complaining about a tie isn't a covered activity.
Exactly. Alice's hatred of her broker's fashion choices and her annoyance with the receptionist have absolutely nothing to do with soliciting, executing, or disposing of funds or securities. Without that third pillar, it is just angry mail. The operations professional can just throw it in the trash or maybe hand it to the broker for a laugh. There is no regulatory reporting requirement.
So the regulators genuinely do not care about customer service issues as long as the money is safe.
Pretty much. FINRA's mandate is market integrity and investor protection from financial harm, not etiquette. Think about the sheer volume of correspondence a major broker-dealer receives daily.
It's got to be millions of messages.
Right. So if compliance officers had to review and retain every complaint about a slow website, a rude email, or bad coffee, they wouldn't have the bandwidth to investigate actual theft or unauthorized trading.
Ah, okay.
So the strict definition is really a filtering mechanism. It ensures that the regulatory apparatus is only triggered when there is a potential risk to customer assets or a violation of sales practices.
That makes a ton of sense. Okay, listener, break out of passive listening mode. I'm going to throw a scenario at you, and I want you to think fast. Same character. Angry Alice decides the handwritten letter didn't get enough attention, so she fires off an email to her broker.
Okay.
The email says, in all caps, "I told you I was getting divorced and needed cash. Why did you buy me 100 shares of Tech Corp when I explicitly told you to sell my positions? I'll give you a beat to think. Does that trigger the formal complaint process?"
Yes. That hits the bullseye.
Let's break down why.
It hits all three pillars perfectly. It is a grievance. You know, she is clearly upset. It is from a customer. And it is directly connected to a covered activity.
The trade itself.
Specifically, the execution of a transaction. Yeah. She alleges the broker bought instead of sold, which is an unauthorized trade.
And that's bad.
That is a massive regulatory issue. That email must be retained, escalated to a principal or compliance, and likely reported to FINRA.
Okay, let's push the boundaries on this because I want to know where the gray areas are. What if the communication isn't a traditional letter or an email? What if Alice gets mad and sends a direct message to her broker on Twitter or like leaves a furious comment on the firm's Facebook page about that Tech Corp trade? Does social media count as in writing?
Absolutely. The medium is less important than the format. A text message, a WhatsApp message, a Twitter DM, an email, a physical letter, they're all considered written communications. If Alice texts her broker, "You stole my money," that is a written customer complaint and must be escalated.
I can easily see an exam question trying to trip someone up by using a text message instead of a letter, hoping the test taker assumes texts are too informal to count.
Oh, they absolutely will. The formality does not matter. The content matters. Does it meet the three pillars? Grievance, customer, covered activity. If yes, and it's in a written format, it's a complaint.
Okay, so Alice is loud and obvious. If she's mad, she's going to put it in writing in all caps, and we can easily filter it using those three pillars. But what keeps me up at night aren't the loud clients. It was the silent threats.
Yeah.
Because if someone is quietly draining a client's account, they are going to send us an angry letter announcing it. So how do we spot the invisible thieves? Let's talk about the shadowy world of potential identity theft. What exactly are we looking for?
We are looking for red flags. And in the regulatory world, specifically under the Identity Theft Red Flags Rules, which is often referred to as Regulation SID, a red flag has a very specific definition.
Okay.
It is a pattern, practice, or specific activity that indicates the possible existence of identity theft.
The word possible feels like it's doing a lot of heavy lifting there.
It is the most important word in the definition. Firms are required to have a written identity theft prevention program. That program must include reasonable policies and procedures to identify these flags, detect them, and respond appropriately. As an operations professional, your mandate is to recognize the indicator before any fraud is actually confirmed.
Okay, before we bring in our shady characters, how do we even spot these patterns in the first place? I imagine operations desks aren't just guessing. What controls are actually in place?
Well, the foundational control is identity verification. You've probably heard of KYC.
Know your customer.
Right. When a person seeks to open an account, the rules state that firms must have reasonable procedures to verify their identity to the extent reasonable and practicable. You can't just take a person's word that they are who they say they are.
Right. They have to submit a driver's license, a passport, something tangible.
Exactly. And the firm has to retain records of the identifying information used, you know, the name, the address, the date of birth, the identification number. But it goes much deeper than just looking at a photo ID.
What else do they check?
The firm is required to cross-reference that information against federal databases. Specifically, they must check lists of known or suspected terrorists or terrorist organizations issued by a federal agency and designated by the Treasury.
Okay, you're talking about the OFAC list, right? The Office of Foreign Assets Control.
Precisely. The OFAC Specially Designated Nationals list. Operations professionals use automated systems to scrub every new account name against these lists. If there's a match, or even a partial match, it requires immediate attention.
Okay, so this brings us perfectly to Shady Sam. Let's play this out. Shady Sam goes online to try and open a new brokerage account with your firm. The automated system flags his application, so it lands on my desk in operations for a manual review.
Okay.
I look at his file. The driver's license he submitted says he lives in a sunny, wealthy suburb in Florida, but the utility bill he uploaded as his secondary proof of residence is routed to a P.O. box in a country that is currently under heavy federal sanctions.
That is a classic discrepancy.
Now, my instinct, playing the devil's advocate here, is to be fair. Maybe Sam is an expat, maybe he's traveling for work and having his mail forwarded. I don't want to accuse the guy of being an international criminal just because his mail setup is weird. Shouldn't I email him, ask for clarification, and wait to prove he's actually committing fraud before I escalate this to compliance?
If you do that, you will fail the exam. And in the real world, you might cost your firm millions.
Oh, wow. Okay.
This is one of the most critical concepts to master. The exam focuses heavily on the warning indicator, not the confirmed outcome. A detected red flag absolutely does not prove identity theft. But the firm must apply its procedures before the underlying problem is completed or confirmed.
So I don't wait for proof.
You do not wait for proof. If you wait for proof, the money's already gone.
Right.
The identity is already stolen. As an operations professional, it is not your job to play detective, interview Shady Sam, and definitively prove he is running an international synthetic fraud ring.
Right. I'm the bouncer, not the lead detective. My job is just to look at the ID, look at the utility bill, recognize that a Florida resident having mail sent to a sanctioned country is highly irregular, and say, that is a pattern or practice indicating the possible existence of identity theft. Boom. Red flag. Escalate.
Spot on. You spot the smoke, you report the smoke. You don't walk into the burning building with a thermometer to confirm the exact temperature of the fire before calling the fire department.
That is such a vivid way to remember it. Spot the smoke, report the smoke. But red flags aren't always found on paperwork or automated OFAC scrubs, right? Let's bring in Panic Paul. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes the threat isn't silent at all. Sometimes it's screaming on the phone.
What's your Paul scenario?
Paul calls into the ops desk on a Tuesday afternoon, hyperventilating. He says, I was at the coffee shop. I left my wallet on the table while I went to grab a napkin, and now it's gone. My driver's license, my credit cards, my social security card, everything is in there. I know they're going to hack my brokerage account. You have to do something.
Classic Paul.
Right. So I look at Paul's account. No unauthorized trades, no missing money. The account is perfectly secure as of this second. Is his phone call a red flag, or is this just Paul being his usual anxious self?
This is a highly testable point, and it's easy to get wrong because, as you noted, nothing bad has actually happened to the account yet.
Right, he's just panicking.
But the rules explicitly specify that a customer notice or a customer concern about possible identity theft can act as a warning indicator.
Wait, really? So Paul waving his arms and yelling about a lost wallet is legally a red flag?
Yes. Under the firm's procedures, panicked Paul's frantic phone call is a red flag. It indicates the possible existence of identity theft because his sensitive identifying information is now out in the wild.
Okay.
The firm has to treat that as a detected red flag and apply the appropriate protective procedures, even though the fraud hasn't occurred.
Entirely different categories of regulatory events. On one side, we have Angry Alice complaining about bad trades. On the other side, we have Shady Sam's weird documents and Panic Paul's lost wallet indicating identity theft.
Right.
The exam is absolutely going to try to blur the lines between these two concepts, aren't they?
It is their favorite way to trip up test takers. They will give you a paragraph-long scenario and ask you to categorize it. If you apply complaint procedures to a red flag, or vice versa, you get the question wrong.
All right, let's do a rapid-fire comparison to set the baseline. I want to give the listener a clear, unbreakable way to tell them apart when they are staring at a tricky multiple-choice question. I'll take complaints, you take red flags. Ready?
Ready, let's do it.
Okay. A complaint always involves a grievance. It
Yeah.
must be about a transaction, the execution of a trade, or the disposing of funds. And critically, it is almost always initiated by the customer or their authorized rep. They are coming to you angry in writing.
On the flip side, a red flag is fundamentally about identity theft. It is an indicator, a pattern, or an anomaly. It is usually spotted internally by the firm's systems, like an OFAC scrub, or by operations personnel reviewing documents. While a customer can flag it, like Paul did, a red flag does not require a grievance or a customer initiation to exist. It is a proactive detection of risk.
Okay, so they live in two distinctly different buckets, the complaint bucket and the red flag bucket. But here is the dual threat scenario. What happens when these two worlds violently collide?
Oh, this is the good stuff.
Let's bring Alice back. What if Angry Alice writes a furious all caps email? It says, "I was reviewing my monthly statement and someone withdrew $10,000 from my account. I did not authorize this. I was out of the country. It wasn't me. You better fix this right now and put my money back."
This is the ultimate exam scenario. You are looking at a hybrid.
Okay, listener, before the expert answers, think about the pillars we just discussed. Which bucket does Alice's email go into? Is it a complaint or is it a red flag? I'll give you a second. Okay, what's the verdict?
The verdict is that it is both.
Both. But how does that work practically? Does one rule supersede the other? Like, if identity theft is involved, is that a bigger deal? So we just drop the complaint procedures and send it straight to the fraud department.
If you do that, you fail.
Ouch. Okay.
Yeah, a qualifying complaint does not become a potential red flag merely because the firm escalates it, nor does a red flag cancel out a complaint. They remain entirely different classifications in the eyes of FINRA and the SEC.
Walk me through the logic there. Why are they both?
Well, apply the definitions we just talked about. Is it a written grievance from a customer about the disposing of funds?
Yes. Alice is furious that 10 grand is gone.
Therefore, it is definitively a complaint under FINRA Rule 4530. It must be logged, retained, and reported. But is it also a specific activity indicating the possible existence of identity theft?
Well, yes. An unauthorized party accessing the account and withdrawing funds is the ultimate red flag.
So they run on parallel tracks.
Ah, I see.
Exactly. If one matter includes both a complaint and a detected red flag, operations personnel must apply the firm's procedure that is relevant to each issue. Complaints and detected identity theft red flags require completely different internal responses.
Let me make sure I'm visualizing this correctly. For the complaint side, I'm routing this to the compliance department or a principal. They have to log it in the firm's complaint file. They might have to notify FINRA, depending on the severity, and they have to officially respond to Alice's grievance about being made whole.
Correct. That satisfies the complaint requirement.
But simultaneously, for the red flag side, I have to route this through the firm's written identity theft prevention program. That means notifying the fraud department, freezing the account so no more money leaves, changing her passwords, and investigating how the breach happened.
Yeah.
So it's two completely different goals, regulatory reporting versus asset protection, triggered by one furious email.
You nailed it. You are satisfying two different regulatory requirements simultaneously. If you only log the complaint but don't freeze the account, the thief steals more money.
Right.
But if you freeze the account but don't log the complaint, you get fined by FINRA for record-keeping violations. You must do both.
That makes incredible sense when you break it down like that. The rules aren't just arbitrary paperwork. They are dual systems designed to protect the client and protect the market.
Exactly.
Okay, we are moving into the final phase of this process. We've recognized the complaint from Alice. We've spotted the red flag from Shady Sam. We've fielded the panicked call from Paul. We know what these things are and we know how to categorize them. Now we have to execute. Let's talk about methods of escalation. I call this the now what phase.
This is where the rubber meets the road. Recognizing the issue is really only half the battle.
Let's establish the absolute baseline rule for an operations professional. What is the golden rule of escalation?
The core rule is this. An associated person who learns of a listed event must promptly report its existence to the member firm.
Promptly report. Let's dig into that, because I think human nature sometimes gets in the way here.
Oh, all the time.
Going back to Shady Sam, I'm sitting at my desk. I'm reviewing his new account application, and I spot the discrepancy. The Florida ID, the sanctioned country PO box, as we established, it's a red flag. But part of me thinks, I'm a smart person. I have Google. Let me just do a little digging on my lunch break. Let me look up this address on Google Earth. Let me search his name on LinkedIn. Let me see if I can figure this out myself before I bother my manager.
That is a terrible impulse.
Hey.
And it is strictly against the rules. You do not investigate it on your own. You do not play detective.
Why not, though? I'm just trying to be helpful and gather facts.
Because every minute you spend playing amateur detective on Google is a minute. The firm's actual security apparatus is not engaged.
Oh, I see.
Furthermore, the firm has a very specific SEC-mandated written identity theft prevention program. That program outlines exactly who handles what. It designates specific personnel, usually a dedicated fraud or AML, anti-money laundering team, to investigate.
So they are the experts, not me.
Exactly. You apply the applicable procedure for that specific issue, which is to promptly route it to them.
Stay in your lane, basically.
Exactly. Stay in your lane and escalate promptly.
Okay, so I follow the rules. I stay in my lane and I escalate Shady Sam's file to the fraud department. What happens next? Does the firm just hit a giant red panic button? Do they automatically freeze the account, call the FBI, and reject the application every single time a red flag is escalated?
Not at all. And this is a massive area for exam questions. The rules state that the firm's response to a detected red flag must be commensurate with the degree of risk.
Commensurate with the degree of risk. That phrase sounds like regulatory poetry. It feels like it's going to be the right answer on a multiple choice question 9 times out of 10.
It very likely will be. The firm handles a detected identity theft red flag under its written prevention program. And that program must include procedures for appropriate responses. But the word appropriate is a sliding scale. It scales up and down based on the specific circumstances of the flag.
Let's test that sliding scale. Listener, here is your final interactive prompt of the day. Think about this deeply. Does every single red flag require the firm to launch a massive investigation or restrict an account? Let's use panicked Paul, but slightly alter the scenario.
Right.
Let's say Paul didn't lose his wallet. Let's say Paul is just trying to update his address on the firm's online portal. He lives in Beverly Hills, zip code 90210, but he has fat fingers and he accidentally types his zip code as 90211.
Happens all the time.
Right. So the firm's automated system instantly flags the update because the zip code doesn't match the city database. Technically, a data mismatch on identifying information is a potential indicator of identity theft. It is, by definition, a red flag. It gets escalated to operations. What is the firm's response to Paul's typo?
Here's the trap they will try to catch you on. Test takers assume that because the word flag is used, action is mandatory, but a detected red flag does not require one fixed response. Depending on the circumstances, the firm may determine that no response is warranted.
Wait, hold on. A red flag is detected, and the legally correct response can be to do absolutely nothing.
Yes, because the response must be commensurate with the degree of risk. If the operations or compliance team reviews the zip code mismatch, looks at Paul's file, and realizes, oh, Paul has lived at this exact street address for 20 years, and the one key is right next to the zero key on a keyboard, the risk of actual identity theft is practically zero.
It's just a clerical error.
Exactly. If the firm deployed the fraud department and froze Paul's account every time a customer made a typo, the system would collapse under the weight of false positives.
Oh, totally.
It would be the boy who cried wolf on an institutional scale. The response must fit the risk. And in that specific circumstance, determining that no response is warranted is entirely compliant with FINRA and SEC rules.
That is a huge paradigm shift for how to approach this material. If a test question says something absolute, like a firm must always restrict account access when a red flag is detected, or a firm must always contact the authorities upon finding a discrepancy, those absolute statements are undeniably false.
False. Regulatory bodies hate absolute, always and never scenarios in this context. The response must match the risk and circumstances. A typo gets a different response than Shady Sam's sanctioned country PO box.
It's all about context, proportion, and understanding the mechanism. I feel like we've really cracked open the why behind these rules today. We aren't just memorizing definitions anymore. We are seeing how the machinery of the firm actually operates to protect clients and filter out the noise.
Yeah, that's exactly what you need to do to pass this exam.
Let us bring all these pieces together for a final sprint of testable takeaways. It is time for the rapid fire recap.
Let's lock this in.
Listener, if you zoned out to check your email, tune back in right now. These are the bullet points you need to have tattooed on the inside of your eyelids for exam day. I'll start us off. Number one, a complaint isn't just a client whining about customer service. To trigger the regulatory rules, it must be a grievance from a customer that connects to soliciting, executing, or disposing of funds or securities.
Number two, written form alone doesn't make an angry letter a formal complaint. A wax-sealed letter about bad coffee doesn't count. But a frantic text message about an unauthorized trade hits all three pillars, and therefore, it is a complaint.
Number three, red flags are about the potential or possible existence of identity theft. Do not wait for confirmation to escalate. Spot the smoke, report the smoke.
Number four, identity verification requires checking federal databases, specifically treasury lists like OFAC, to ensure you aren't opening accounts for known or suspected terrorists. And you must retain the records of the ID you use to verify them.
Number five, complaints and red flags can, and often do, overlap. If Angry Alice's funds are stolen by an unauthorized user, it's both. And if they overlap, you don't combine them into one process. You apply the specific procedures for both simultaneously on parallel tracks.
And finally, number six, escalation responses to red flags must fit the risk. It is not a one-size-fits-all panic button. It must be commensurate with a degree of risk. And sometimes, depending on the circumstances, like a simple typo, the mathematically and legally correct regulatory response is that no response is warranted.
Nailed it. That recap right there is pure gold for the Function 2 section of the Series 99.
It really is. If you understand those 6 points, you can navigate almost any scenario the exam throws at you.
Before we wrap up, I want to leave you with a thought that goes beyond the textbook, something to chew on as you study this material.
Sure.
We've talked entirely about human operations professionals today. You know, you looking at Alice's email, you reviewing Sam's ID. But think about how artificial intelligence and machine learning are going to completely upend this landscape in the next 5 to 10 years.
It's already starting to happen, honestly.
Right. As algorithms get smarter, they're going to be the ones reading the emails to determine if it meets the three pillars of a complaint. AI is going to be the primary filter determining if a zip code mismatch is just a typo or a sophisticated synthetic identity attack.
Yeah.
But here's the regulatory gray area. When an algorithm is the one making the judgment call and it incorrectly decides that no response is warranted for Shady Sam, who does a finder not hold responsible, is it the ops professional who trusted the dashboard? Is it the firm's compliance officer? Is it the software developer?
That is the exact debate happening in regulatory circles right now. The rules were written for human judgment. Adapting commensurate with risk to an AI black box is going to be the next great challenge for this industry.
It's wild to think about. The tech evolves, but the need to protect the market remains the exact same. Something to keep in mind as you enter this field. Keep reviewing, keep thinking about the why behind these rules, and you are going to absolutely crush this exam. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.